In particular this evening, I want to focus on quite why same-sex marriage is worth contending against in the public square. The backdrop for this are three theses that I developed earlier in the day, which I'm just going to remind you of after our excellent first course. First of all, we work in a world that thinks it is good and we aren't. Secondly, we work in a world that thinks it is pro-love and we aren't. And thirdly, we work in a world where sophists have become Pharisees. This means we're speaking into a situation where those who oppose us have the characteristic Pharisaical problem of self-righteousness and contempt for those with whom they disagree, and in particular, pride themselves on upholding love, while in fact attenuating, thinning out both God's love for sinners and the right kind of responsive, repentant love that sinners should have for the God who saves by his grace. Earlier, if you remember, we finished off with the challenge of articulating to those with whom we disagree a richer account of love and a more biblical account of love. Now, though, we need to focus more on the challenge of a law permitting and enforcing same-sex marriage. Please note the way that I'm actually putting that. It's not just a question of permitting same-sex marriage. Laws permitting same-sex marriage in our situations, whether here or north of the equator, inevitably are laws which enforce it. My basic thesis, if you like, is that we're facing a paradox here of a law-bloated society that is covertly lawless. I am, these days, a hag-ridden, hoary old operator in the rough, tough world of English theological education. It is not all thin-sliced cucumber sandwiches. As such, I am the leader, I am a legal consumer as the leader of a small theological college, a small charitable business with about 30 staff, some real estate, and some 150 students. What does it feel like? Schizophrenic. Yes, I'm grateful that my faculty currently has freedom of thought and expression in the classroom, and that our staunchly Protestant trust deeds are, for the present, completely legal. I'm grateful there's a police force which maintains law and order in my bit of North London, and that my family and I have access to healthcare and the courts. On the other hand, as I go about exercising my religious freedom, I daily experience being hemmed in by ever-increasing regulation. Others experience this too, but my experience as a citizen is increasingly of a Kafkaesque UK, where rules breed like rabbits, and where it is hugely difficult to keep up with, let alone comply with, the next batch of regulations. I am now the first line in N14 4PS, the postcode of my college, in the battle against terrorism. It fills you with confidence. Their precise ambit, these new rules, are anxiety-provokingly unclear, and the regulations, whatever they momentarily are defended with real moral intensity. When you have had to redo the floor of one of your basement rooms in order to be able to sustain a new library there, and you are told that you have to do it with 18th century building techniques, and this is told to you with moral passion, you do find yourself reaching for the gin and tonic. It's not that I experience no more. I do. But at the same time, as a UK citizen, perhaps especially as a Christian citizen, I experience the bewildering labyrinth of stifling and impending regulations. Schizophrenic. This bears on why I think we must contest this issue and explain why we must. The jargon term for what I've just described is juridification. What difference does it make to the question of a law relating to same-sex marriage? After all, it's not an obvious given that that Christian conduct in recent years means that we should be involved in the public square. So before I unpack how juridification does play out in Northern Hemisphere Europe, let me contrast two different models of church life. First of all, there is the church's mirror. Here, church life mirrors society in which we're set. So it's well-intentioned. You go out collecting for Christian aid, it will be generous where it can, and contributes to the relief of poverty overseas. It fits in with the culture around it, often because it wants to identify something positive in that culture. The causes it supports are largely those the surrounding culture thinks right. Accordingly, to take the issue of the day, it will support same-sex marriage. It certainly can, as a church, cause discomfort and even offence to some because of its stance on, for instance, human trafficking and ethical investment. But the offence it causes is actually very safe. It is an offence that, as it were, has already been legitimated. The offence it causes has already been approved, received the imprimatur of significant opinion media formers like Bishop Sydney Morning Herald. A safe offence because it's critically about a chic cause. Commitment to these causes certainly will be heartfelt, deeply, but championing these causes is a mark of belonging to society, rather than of standing against it and speaking prophetically against it. These are the areas where society, or more accurately its opinion formers, are already moving. Put another way, our culture already believes that people trafficking is wrong. It doesn't need us to persuade us of that, to persuade it of that. It may need motivation to do something about it, but actually all we're really asking it to do at that point is honour its own ideals. Now, don't misunderstand me. It's excellent that our culture and its liberal churches think people trafficking is wrong. The point is, people tend to think that whether or not they're Christian. Agreeing with a Christian that people trafficking is wrong does not mean accepting the rest of that Christian's beliefs. So when I say, I as a Christian proclaim that people trafficking is wrong, this is actually very safe. Well-intentioned, but profoundly safe. After all, people trafficking is seen as so much procedure wrong that our culture is just glad that we've at least got that one right and less concerned with how we got there. If anything, I suggest they think along the lines of, well, she may be a Christian, but at least she's got that one. Please note some interesting features. First, this vision of Christian life risks being fairly works-based, doesn't it? You show, you prove your Christianity by adhering to the causes of the day, whether it's people trafficking, prisoner rehabilitation or whatever. The causes may be great, but there is that question, is being a Christian actually pretty much acting out contemporary political correctness, whatever form political correctness takes in your particular culture? Secondly, if you're showing and proving your Christianity by adhering to the causes of the day, what about the churchgoers who don't support them? Is there not a risk that one starts to weigh their Christianity too on the basis of what you see, and what you see is conduct you think is not Christian? There's never a risk of legalism. I think so. The third thing is this. Does this kind of gospel actually have good news for a people trafficker? Or is redemption just for those trafficked? This has always been a problem with the liberation theologies of the 20th century. They drew attention to real injustice, I think. But the question is not whether there is good news for the poor and oppressed, but whether there is in those systems any good news of forgiveness for repentant, rich, and oppressors. In what sense does a church like this actually have good news for people who really are sinners, like people trafficking? And if so, what is it? Then there's a different kind of church life, where one is not clearly mirroring the surrounding culture, but is fully immersed in a Bible-teaching church. It is a deeply satisfying life, because two or three evenings a week, you're taken up with church activities. There'd be a prayer meeting, probably some other groups like Mums and Tots, a house group, certainly, hopefully a reading group. Much of Sunday will be spent doing church. There'll be church weekends away, another significant but satisfying time commitment. There'll be commitment to outreach, costing time, effort, and possibly, depending on who comes to your evenings, uncomfortable. It will, though, be satisfying and faithful. In terms of understanding of oneself, one is first and foremost a Christian, one is committed to work or career for sure, but with the qualification that one does it to honour one's employers for the Lord's sake. But life, in fact, revolves around the church family. Please note, this too is a very safe life, or has been. This is a safe life because it is not heard publicly and is safely unknown in the public square and safely ignored. Recently, for instance, I'm in conversation with a well-informed academic in academic administration in a university near us who was astonished to hear that actually some churches may reach three figures in their congregations, incredulous that some London churches have roles in their thousands. He has simply never heard of this. It is unknown, and it is a little bit unwelcome. So two very different kinds of church life. To some extent, of course, they're consciously contrasting visions. Now let me be clear, if you push me, then despite my criticisms, I prefer the second vision of church life. Why? Because it preserves more of the gospel intact. It is more faithful to the gospel as I understand it. There is genuinely good news for sinners, including the people traffickers, and a stress on grace not works, and a stress on the saving cross of Christ. But both share much. This commonality comes about because both visions feature model citizens. Very safe citizens, because they are not, at the moment, public defence citizens. It's intriguing how much UK public order legislation circles around that concept of public defence. It goes right back to the 1936 Public Order Act in the days when people were legislating against fascism. Have you done something that offends someone in public and leads them to disorder? More recently, the UK Public Order Act 1986, sections 12 and 14, enshrine the idea that an official may take action not just when someone himself or herself causes serious public disorder, but if their assemblies or processions may result in that from others. I'm covered not just when I do the rioting, but when I provoke my opponents to kick over the traces, even if that's unreasonable. UK public order laws want me to be a low-risk citizen. Now, at first glance, that second vision of Christian life certainly is very inoffensive. Inoffensive because it does not rock public life or public order, because it raises little or no voice in the public square. What offence there is about the cross tends to take place behind closed doors by invitation only. To that extent, that second vision of Christian life is life with a shadow identity. It looks like full immersion in the life of Christ, but there is also a shadow identity, that of citizen. The citizen in 21st century secular Britain, bearing in mind, as we heard earlier, that secular is a reasonable word. Those two different identities, the strong Christian identity and the shadow identity of a perfect citizen, can be maintained side by side precisely because they don't meet. And there is no doubt that a big bit of many of us says, that's fine. Let's keep on doing things like that. The question is whether that strong sense of Christian identity and that shadow identity of safe citizen can be kept conveniently apart. Less and less so. Less and less particularly because of same-sex marriage. Here we turn to the major issue that I identified earlier in the day, the process of juridification. Broadly here, we're talking about the phenomenon whereby more and more of the behaviour of citizens is regulated directly or indirectly by the state. That means that the boundary between the public square and what goes on safely in the private sphere is constantly shifting. It is not a stable boundary. Rather, juridification means that the state is constantly extending its boundaries into what used to be thought of as private. This means that as we think about the viability of the Christian immersed in church life, we should note that the state does encroach on areas that are church, potentially the regulation of Sunday schools, youth clubs, provision of services, and the sense of conducting marriage ceremonies and so on. Can you see how same-sex legislation has the potential to erode precisely that nice, safe, private-public divide? It's a thing of the past. And that erosion follows from the process of juridification. Further, even when the initial rules that get applied look innocent enough, juridification includes the way that an area of life becomes open to regulation. That's obviously one of the issues over same-sex marriage in the UK. Current UK legislation allows a conscience exemption for Anglican clergy over refusing to conduct same-sex marriages. But this means that in principle, the issue is open for legislation. And my right of conscience depends on the state, and what the state gives, it could surely take away. In any case, with the UK and Europe, the form that legislation now takes, as it extends the public square, is highly significant. The fashion is the very broadly framed rules. I have, for instance, to make reasonable provision to ensure equal non-discriminatory access in our applications process. Now, as of 3 months ago, at our last inspection, we're not getting caned for that. But the reason for that is not that we are clearly keeping the law. The reason is that we fall outside the current prosecution policy. I don't know for sure if we're keeping the law, and I don't know whether the enforcement authorities will change their policy tomorrow. If you like, it's that difference between driving down King Street, knowing that the speed limit is 50 kilometres, and you get prosecuted once you're past that, and driving down King Street, knowing that there's some kind of speed limit, but not what it is precisely, because the traffic police prosecute you depending on whether they reckon you're driving at a reasonable speed or have dark hair. Note two things here. First, the rule of law in the sense of the citizen knowing predictably what his or her liabilities are has just gone right out of the window. Secondly, what the law really is effectively laid down by the prosecuting agency. Think in terms of Montesquieu's separation of powers. In the spirit of the laws, Montesquieu draws a distinction between legislative, executive, and judiciary. But here, in this juridification process, the separation of powers breaks down because the enforcement agency, the executive in effect, has such an extensive say in what the law is and where it applies. It has a legislative function, and whether I've actually broken it, it has a judicial function. Now, obviously, political theory has gone through a few phases since Montesquieu, but there's still rugged good sense in the separation of powers, not least because sin means it is not a good idea to leave any given official with too much power. Another significant feature in the current wave of juridification is its increasing tendency to blur the legal and the moral. Put sharply, one big difference between the UK's 1967 Race Relations Act and now is that we are no longer content to regulate discrimination in the provision of goods and services, but we are moving to suppression of certain kinds of thought. So English state secondary schools very frequently now have a presence from same-sex advocacy groups such as Stonewall, and the focus here is the acceptance, the affirmation of same-sex relations under the guise of educating children out of homophobic bullying. Please note here, I'm describing a process whereby we have lots of law, but the law is, so to speak, undoing itself. The kind of juridification I described undoes, it dissolves, the great legal virtue of the rule of law. But the values it is increasingly advocating also undo the very function of the state in God's economy, which is the restraint of vice and the reward of virtue. What contributes to this weird situation where the law undoes itself? Let me pick up two features: democracy as it's currently assumed, and the cult of individual rights. In both cases, while both areas talk so much of law, there is an element of lawlessness. Let me explain. Democracy, of course, is one of the highest value goods in our current public square, and in a sense, rightly. It is a feel-good word, it's highly emotionally charged, So it feels odd to talk about democratic tyranny. On first hearing, you might think that the idea of democratic tyranny is just sour grapes, what people say when they are outvoted. Naturally, calling something tyranny can be simply a term of abuse, but that's not what we're getting at here. Rather, we want to use it in a precise analytical way. You see, there's a long and respectable stream of Christian theology that analyses when state action or laws become tyrannical. Let me introduce you to the Italian Renaissance humanist thinker Salutati, not necessarily a household name, but he synthesizes much of this Christian debate. For Salutati, the first thing to do with any authority is analyze what makes it an authority. Is it something that sets itself up or something that holds power from another? Christianly, you have to say that all authority ultimately derives from God. A tyrant is someone who does derive power from another, someone who holds authority because it's been given to him by somebody else, and who then, in some way, whether explicitly or implicitly, repudiates the law that sets him up as an authority. Now, for Salutati, the tyrant can do this in various different ways. Obviously, he can oppress the people over whom he or she has been given charge, for example, by feathering his own nest, or favouring his cronies, or giving them places in the House of Lords or baronetcies if they happen to be retiring UK prime ministers. No agenda. But note this, he can also do this by conniving and colluding with the people that he rules against his and their overlord. He may refuse to discharge his responsibilities in some respect by not enforcing laws that his overlord wants enforced. That's tyranny too, says Salutati. And please note, this latter category of tyranny is going to look it's going to look really good and be very popular. It'll have mass backing. Laws aren't being enforced. Of course it will. Suppose the tyrant remits the taxes that his overlord has asked for. It's still tyranny, because it refuses to be under another's rightful rule. It's still a refusal to be under law, even if you dress it up as a democracy. It's lawlessness. This line of thought goes back to the early medieval theologian John of Salisbury, who sees tyranny at work in the state, in the home, and in the church. In each case, it's the repudiation of law. It's there in Thomas Aquinas, ably represented in the Protestant tradition by Samuel Rutherford, and his insistence that law is sovereign. Lex, rex, law is king, not rex, lex, the king is law. But remember, just because a democracy has become tyrannical does not mean it makes no laws. It may make its own laws a lot. This is almost unsayable, isn't it? That a democracy can be a tyrant. But would we really say democracy is an absolute good? Not just a good, but the good. We'd immediately want to add to some qualification, wouldn't we? If, for instance, and the French theorist Alexis de Tocqueville uses this example, if you're a Native American around 1840, you're not going to be too pro-democracy, because it's precisely democracy which has been used to strip you of your land and leave your people destitute and starving, because you're a minority. And in de Tocqueville's phrase, there is a tyranny of the majority. Tyranny clad in democratic form. Democratically elected presidents, democratic laws, democratic courts, all of which worked to perpetrate gross injustice on Native Americans. And it's not just American history. It's UK history too. It is a form of lawlessness, isn't it? To say, vox populi, vox Dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God. Because one's saying the people are not under law. They speak for God. Dangerous stuff. This is a breathtaking saying. Even in the early medieval period, when the jurisprudence says about the King of England, even back then, which we don't think of as being a particularly enlightened time, he says of the King of England that he is sub Deo et sub Lege, under God and under law. It's no answer to say that a democracy has safeguards, 2/3 majority for the amendment of a Bill of Rights or something like that. The point is, a majority can amend it. I most need protection from the majority precisely when there are 3/4 of them against me as an individual. The point is, a majoritarian kind of trigger like that, we're just talking about how big a majority. Tragically, the UK debate on same-sex showed a democracy that didn't really think it was accountable to anything above it. In that sense, it's lawless. There again, what about the second great feature of our public square, our rights culture, our rights discourse? I do, though, want to say that, do want to nuance that a little by saying that it's not just that we're living in a rights culture, but in an entitlement culture, a narcissistic culture. The American social psychologist Jean M. Twenge, and the reason why I'm citing Jean M. Twenge is, one, she is very, very good, and two, I love being able to say Twenge. Jean M. Twenge shows that if you stack up the statistics year by year of American students entering university programs, you see the narcissist profile rising and rising. Now, I, of course, as a late middle-aged man, am thinking, absolutely, and I do my whole grumpy old man bit and talk about young people today. Then on the next page, Twenge observes acidly that we also see that the same cohort of people who were young in the 60s, nurtured and matured in the 70s and 80s, took jobs in the 90s, demonstrate the same trend to increasing narcissism. It's me too. It's not just the next generation. There's a Latin proverb, of course, that captures it nicely. The times change, and we are changed in them. And so too with us. Can I really say that as I watch the entitlement culture around me, that I haven't been infected by it? Entitlement, as Twenge observes, isn't really earned. It's given to me as a right. As a right. Key observation for her is all those American cars driving down the highway with princess on board. An odd sentiment, of course, for a nominally republic country, but nevertheless, princess on board. It says entitlement and royalty, that kind of thing. In the words of the L'Oreal advert, which you probably have here, certainly transmitted in Europe, you're worth it. And of course, when I talk about that kind of entitlement, that kind of right, I'm talking about something which I don't even have to earn. Increasingly, I'm talking about something I confer on myself. You owe it to me. I think I'm so important, so wonderful just by being me, that actually all kinds of things should be done for me. I confer my own entitlement, or I and my friends in collusion do, and we confer it on each other. And Twenge makes the point that when an entitlement generation and an entitlement people are challenged, the response is disbelief and rage. Third point about rights. Isn't it remarkable that we speak so much of rights and so little of duties? We have a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but no Universal Declaration of Human Duties. It's interesting historically. If you go back into the 19th century, you find that the founder of UK humanist secularism, the coiner of the term secularism, even Holyoake, has been so malign as an influence in so many ways, starts by speaking of duties. If you look at his successor organisations now, Humanist Association, National Secularist Association, etc., etc., what do you find? It's all morphed into a statement of my rights. The 19th century theorist Giuseppe Mazzini saw this coming. He said, it's all very well to talk about the duties of man, the rights of man, which we associate with Thomas Paine, but what we really must do is talk about the duties of man, duties set by God. After all, why should I accept your account of your rights when they conflict with mine? Why should you confine my rights? The Roman Catholic theorist Marcello Pera, just at the moment, is making exactly the case that if Europe is really serious about rights, it needs to recover the grounds that gave them. And it wasn't atheist secularism that did. It needs to recover its Christian heritage. which means recovering the concept of individual duty. Fourth and last point about rights. And for our purposes this evening, this is the most important. The way we speak of individual rights implies that others are under a duty to respect them. Covertly, but they are. Work that through in the same-sex marriage instance. When you say same-sex couples have the right to marry and enter that institution, you're actually saying that the rest of us will be under a duty to recognise that marriage. This is not a case, it's not relativism of saying, oh, well, right for you, wrong for me, or whatever, good for you, not good for me. It is not a relativist conception of rights at all. It is coercive. This is the point we did not make forcibly enough in the UK debate, and you must. We did not strongly challenge enough that same-sex marriage was not just letting a group have a liberty. Same-sex marriage goes way beyond that. It is not just saying, you do that if you feel like it. It is saying, we all recognise that you are what you say you are, a married couple. Same-sex marriage, in that sense, is impositional and coercive. That is why the UK government had to put an exception in for Anglican clergy. Not for everyone, of course, just Anglican clergy, because we tend to get cut off the list, only providing services for marriage. But it gives the game away, doesn't it? Yes, it's coercive. It's saying, yes, when it comes to the hiring of that church hall, of course, the same-sex married couple has the same right to have its reception there as the heterosexual couple that married in the registry office. Of course it's saying that. This is not about choice. This is about coercion. With this, it's reinforced, of course, by one of the points that the people have been making earlier about the use of language. Consider what Ian was telling us earlier about how, I think it was in Ontario you were talking about, how in Ontario it's not enough to say, we will try and stamp out homophobic bullying. No, it goes beyond that. What the government wants, what it wanted, actually was affirmation. It wants the, yes, you're right. Very telling. The rhetoric of affirmation. And if you don't provide that rhetoric of affirmation, of course, then the risk is that we'll be written off as simply saying hate speech. Hate speech. When you say you disagree with me, it's hate speech. But that, again, is impositional, isn't it? It's saying, even when you try and express yourself in as ironical way as possible, that's not good enough, because actually you disagree with me in what I think. It doesn't necessarily mean hate. That, again, I think is one of your challenges. But there are so many impositions, not just of alien values, but of thoroughly corrupted values and virtues that actually go on in this debate. And that must be exposed. And that was one of the areas where we failed, I think. So whether we're talking about democracy or the way that rights theories have developed at the popular level, certainly, what we're talking about in an important sense is lawlessness. Because there is nothing above me. I'm entitled, I'm the final reference point, or I and my friends are. And that abolishes the gospel. It abolishes the gospel by abolishing the idea that I am in any sense really under law. Now all of this is not an explicit repudiation of God's law, but it does set us up to see ourselves in principle in some areas of life as not under law, not under anyone's law, even God's. And that sense that we are not under law does not stop when we walk into a church building. I will feel as entitled to my sexuality or whatever it is as I step inside churches when I stand outside. So let me state here something very obvious theologically. Individuals and states, even democracies, where there is a massive consensus working together, remain under law, in the sense of God's law. That is amply attested in the scriptures, not least by the book of Daniel and certainly by Romans 13. Our current trend to juridification is savagely ironic, in that the lawless are using law more and more. In fact, democracy and individualist rights seem to feed off each other, since one of the burgeoning areas of legal growth is making rules about things that some individuals feel entitled to, but which wouldn't have been areas for legislation in previous generations. Think of the regulations about providing services irrespective of conscience commitments. What's more, this public square will be increasingly hostile to the gospel and unwilling to tolerate it. In its lawlessness, it will increasingly resent Christian faith because it will see it as authoritarian legalism. In its law-bloatedness, it will increasingly resent Christian faith because as we deny that democracies can legislate morals, we look lawless to them. The flip side of saying our public square is lawless and law-bloated is that correspondingly, it sees us as legalist and lawless. As such, it will feel bound to intervene to restrict what it sees as our legalism at the expense of others' rights, and to impose legal duties on what it sees as our antinomian lawlessness. Its values do battle with the gospel. I haven't actually produced a text for this talk yet, but my text actually will be Acts chapter 4, 18 and 19. If you remember, Peter and John are instructed not to preach in this name. Classic intervention. Why not? You know, we're not actually telling you not to believe something, but you can't preach it. Who should we obey? God or human beings? Obey God, not human beings. And that's because you love God and everything that he's done. And it is also because you love your neighbours. You are doing them no favours in the long run if you do not contend in the public square.